we see all these qualifications, we start to realize this person is going to be shepherding the souls of people. This person is going to be making the decisions about how to carry out the matters of doing the church's work, the expedience, how to decide on which course to take when the Lord has not dictated how we're to go on a certain matter. The elders have to make a judgment. You see these qualifications, and it leads you to understand what they're going to do. However, we want to be a little bit more detailish in the next few weeks. After we finish talking about the qualifications, we want to get into some more specifics about how the elders work. And so we will be doing that afterward. But before we talk some about these two qualifications that we have tonight, the first is not a novice, and the second is of good report to those who are outside, among those who are not members of the church, having a good report among those who are not members of the church. Those are our two for tonight from 1 Timothy 3, 6, and 7. But I wanted to mention something about the connection between the subject of marriage and the subject of the eldership. One connection. There may be more. But you know, I'm fixing to get married soon, so I've been doing a little bit of study on marriage. I really have been trying to make more of a detailed study on the Bible doctrine of marriage than I have done before. And I figure I'm about to get into something. I might as well know a pretty good bit about what it is I'm about to get into. And it's very interesting to consider that in 1 Peter 3:7, when Peter says that husbands are to give their wives honor as the weaker vessel, the word that's translated honor, that husbands are to give to their wives, is the same word that's translated honor in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 17, which says that elders who rule well are to be counted of double honor. And so we are to be honoring our elders. And I hope that one of the things we're doing in this class is to either directly or indirectly be giving commendation to our good elders. Because we have good elders. We have men who are dedicated to the truth of the Bible and who have no agenda other than helping people go to heaven and shepherding the souls of the family here at Mackland, of this flock. And we have men who are Bible students. We have men who are prayerful men. We have men who are mature and who don't make decisions just off the spur of the moment. They don't make flighty decisions. They're not flippant about things. We have men who are wise, especially in the sense that they take care to think about what are the consequences of this decision or that decision. Before we do this, let's think about what could the result of this be. Can we see as best we can, look in the future and figure this out? I'm privileged to be in some of the elders' meetings, and of course you're always welcome to come to an elders' meeting if you ever want to as well, but I sit in there and I see them, how they deal with making decisions. And it's very impressive to watch because they've been doing it, in this case, they've been doing it for a number of years, but they're also just mature men who are not novices. And not novices at being an elder, but also not novices at being Christians. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So spiritual men, and we're very thankful for them, and we want to commend them as we do this class. And I heard a story this week that made me think of this especially, about a preacher in Texas, and he went, this is a true story. He went to work at the office one day. I think it was a Monday morning. And he came in and he saw in the church library there one of his elders. And the elder was sitting there with his head just down like this. And he wasn't praying. And the preacher asked him, "What is wrong?" And this was unusual for him. He was not a sad personality. He was very bubbly, outgoing, energetic personality, a happy man, and just overtly, genuinely a delight to be around in terms of his friendliness and his outgoing and lively personality. And the preacher said, "What is the matter?" And he said, "I am absolutely starved and just dying for a word of commendation from somebody." And that is just a tragedy. If a congregation never commends its elders in any regard and never encourages them, can you imagine what the Lord must think if there is a church of people and they have good elders and they never commend them and never tell them how appreciative they are of them? I'm not saying we have that situation. I don't think we do. But let's remember that of all the members of the church, we encourage one another a whole lot. And I hope that we do a good job of telling each other when we need to be told that we're doing a good work, and we say, appreciate you, keep up the good work. I think in general we do a pretty good job of that here. But the people who need the encouragement the most may be the people who are bearing the weight of more problems in the church. So many of the problems that are in the church, I never hear about. And because they're individual struggles that you may have, or you may have, or you may have, but the elders know about it, and they're dealing with the weight of those struggles, and they need our encouragement and commendation. So let's never neglect to give them the honor that they deserve. And then also, we're thinking about Romans 13:7, which says that Christians are people who give honor to whom honor is due. And the elders certainly are in that category. But now another connection. We said the word for honor that the husband gives the wife is the same word for the honor that Christians give to their elders. But then also notice that wives submit to their husbands, and the church submits to its elders. Now, why is it that God set up that system? I think there are a number of reasons. But think about the case with a husband and a wife. Now, of course, a husband has a loving golden rule attitude toward his wife. Husbands are commanded to love their wives and to be willing to even lay down their lives for them and to love them as Christ loved the church. So this is a very high calling. I can't express to you, the more I study Ephesians 5 about husbands' love for their wives, the more I just think, I don't know if I can do this. I mean, this is extremely, extremely difficult to even imagine doing for a human being anything that closely approximates what Jesus has done for the church. So I'm intimidated by it in a way. But now I know that marriage is for human beings, and so I know that it must be possible for a human being to do this, so I'm going to give it my best shot. But when you think about what Ephesians 5 says about husbands loving their wives, but then wives obeying their husbands in everything. It doesn't say wives obey your husbands if you think he's got a pretty good idea. It says obey them in everything. Now, what does that mean? It means that husbands have the authority over their wives, not in matters where God has spoken. Because you remember what the apostles said in Acts 4. They said, we've got to obey God rather than men. Okay, so if God has spoken on something, neither the husband nor the wife has any authority to contradict what God has already said. But what about those other matters? What about matters of judgment, where God has left it up to human beings as to how to live in order to carry out the commands that he's given? Well, in all of those cases, in everything else where God has not spoken, the husband has the authority over the wife. Now, does that mean he's above getting counsel from his wife, getting advice from his wife, getting thoughtful input from his wife? Certainly not. And he should seek that. He should seek her wisdom. There are many times where I suspect the wife is wiser than the husband, but, I mean, she chose to marry this guy, and she is under his authority. So in all matters of judgment, in everything where God has not spoken, he is in charge. Now, he can delegate and must delegate many areas of life, and the wife makes many decisions. And hopefully, if she's a Christian, she's making all those decisions wonderfully well. But now, shift gears and think about the church for a minute. The church ruled by the elders. Hebrews 13:17 says that we're to obey those who have the rule over us. Now, what does that mean? Again, it's not in areas where God has spoken. If God has dictated what we're supposed to do, then the elders don't have any authority there. The elders can't change what God has already put in place. But in everything else, the elders have the rule. There are areas where there's a matter of judgment. And in both the case of the husband and the wife, and in the case of the elders in the church, somebody has to make the judgment calls. Somebody has to be the one who says, okay, God has left this up to us, and based on our best judgment and based on the input that we have gotten, here's what we're going to do. Somebody has to make the call. What if neither the husband nor the wife had the authority to make the judgment? What if God had not made a decision about that? Well, then you get at loggerheads, and there nothing can be done because the wife says, I have every bit as much right as you to make the judgment call in this matter, so I'm not going to budge. But if she's a godly wife, she'll say, here's what I think we ought to do, but I recognize that You're the husband and you have the authority. What about in the case of the church? If nobody's got the authority on what to do in matters of judgment, well, then if we get at loggerheads and one person says, I'm not budging, but you see, if we're Christians, Hebrews 13, 17 holds. And we say, we love the Lord and we're going to help our elders in whatever way we can by giving them our judgments about things and say, here's our thought on it, but we respect you as elders and you get to make the judgment call. So just a brief comparison there. Any comments or questions about that? We will have several classes where matters like that will be discussed, but I just thought as I was thinking about wives and the church and so forth today, I thought that might be good to talk about. Remember, Proverbs 15:22 says that a multitude of counselors is a good thing. And remember, there's a plurality of elders. And so you might start to get some idea of why there's a plurality of elders when you think about how that various minds coming at an issue may address it in a different way and may see things that the other minds don't see. And so it's very important that you have more than just one elder. All right, now our topic for tonight is coming from this passage. Therefore, an overseer must be not a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders so that he might not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil. From another translation, a bishop then must be not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. So you see these two qualifications. He can't be a novice, and he can't be have a bad report among those people who are without. Rather, he must have a good report. One more translation. The bishop, therefore, must be not a novice, lest being puffed up, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony from them that are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Okay, now let's look at what this phrase means when it says not a novice. It means a neophyte or one who has recently become a Christian. Neo and phyte have to do with neo, new, and phyte having to do with somebody planted. So it literally means somebody newly planted, like a plant that just got put down into the ground. And so when we think about a man who is a neophyte in Christianity or a novice, that means somebody who has recently become a Christian. It means somebody who is new to the Lord's church. He is a new member. And what we're saying is then an elder can't be that. It also means, according to another lexicon, one newly planted in the Christian community or newly converted. It means newly planted, a neophyte. So that's the word. Any questions or comments about the meaning of the word? I'm not sure if that is contained in this word, but I can surely say that it would be unwise to appoint somebody who's brand new to a congregation. The question was, does this word also implicate that it can't be somebody who is a new member at this particular congregation, although he may have been a Christian for many years? And the answer is, I can't say for sure that that is in the meaning of the word. However, I think we can see that if we don't know this person, it's going to be very hard for us to tell if he's qualified or not. Even if he's been a Christian for many years, how are we to assess whether somebody meets any of these qualifications? It's going to be based on our knowledge of him. And if he's been a member at Timbuktu for the past 35 years, that's wonderful, and we're glad that he has been a Christian for that long, but he's going to have to demonstrate to us as the sheep here that he meets these qualifications. Otherwise, we wouldn't know if we were following the passage or not, right? Okay, good question, though. What else? That's right, yes. Yes, blameless. I think the word you're looking for is Now, of good report has to do with people who are outside the congregation, and that is applicable. More directly applicable is that qualification, blameless, that we looked at before, because we have to know his character enough to know that there are no outstanding sins where we could look at any passage of the Bible and say, he just doesn't follow that. Any passage that applies to him and say, well, look at his life. It's obvious that he doesn't follow this verse. He's got to be blameless about that. Doesn't mean he's a perfect man, but it means he's a faithful Christian. Remember, it's interesting to me, by the way, that in Titus 1, Titus is called to appoint elders in every city in Crete. Well, what kind of culture was Crete? If you do much study about that, you're going to think Crete is a whole lot like America today. I mean, Titus says, chapter 1, verses 12 and 13, describes the culture this way. They're evil beasts, they're lazy gluttons, they are liars. They're liars, they're evil beasts, they're lazy gluttons. Now, appoint elders out of that group. Well, how's that going to work? It's going to work because of the influence of Christianity there, also perhaps by miraculous working of the Holy Spirit in the first century. But, in other words, what we're saying is, it's possible for people to be called out of the culture in which they are and to become faithful Christians and to develop into godly elders, even in a corrupt culture, such as the one we increasingly find ourselves in. But he's got to be blameless. In other words, if there's a sin that's prominent in our culture that seems like a lot of people do, like Cretans, Paul says, Cretans are liars. Well, now look at your elder, the man you're thinking of putting up as an elder, and especially look at that one. Because if everybody else is a liar, does he fall into that? You know, Paul wrote in Romans chapter 2, he said, you say that you shouldn't lie. Y'all are preaching that we shouldn't lie. Do you lie? Or you say, you preach that people shouldn't commit adultery. Do you commit adultery? And so, especially if there are popular sins, we need to give a special attention to those and see if he's blameless in that regard. Okay, what else? Anything before we talk about this some? Now, we need to notice there is such thing as a novice. Otherwise, there would be no need to put this in there. So, it is a legitimate thing to look at a man before we get ready to appoint him and say, let's ask ourselves, is he a novice? He might be a great guy and still be a novice. In fact, he might be a very moral man and still be a novice. And that's no reflection on his character, is it? It just means he's not quite ready yet. And it may be that he'll be a great elder one day and that he's on the right track to being an elder. But he's a novice. Okay, so let's think about what that would be. A novice who is appointed is liable to fall into pride and the condemnation of the devil. That's what the passage says. If you appoint a novice, he's liable to fall into pride. He's liable to, as one translation says, he's liable to get puffed up and then fall into this condemnation of the devil. And so we want to especially be careful about this. It's an important one. And to puff up literally means to make proud, to render insolent, to blind with pride or conceit, to render foolish or stupid. Now, somebody read 1 Peter 5:5 for us. Would one of you men read 1 Peter 5:5 along these lines about being puffed up? What does that say? This would apply to all Christians, so I think it's important for us to all see this. God resists the proud, so you can't have somebody who's an elder who's proud, but you're liable to get that if you appoint somebody who is a novice, who's new. He's liable to start thinking more highly of himself than he ought to think, and that is the definition of pride, if you think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. Now, it's not wrong to think highly of yourselves, but it's wrong to think more highly than you ought to think. Obviously, each of us should think very highly of ourselves because Christ died on the cross for each of us individually. So that means each of us is very important. But we need to remember that we're equally important and we are equally in need of God's grace and mercy at the foot of the cross. Very good. Okay, that's the danger You appoint somebody who's not ready, who's a novice, he's liable to be puffed up. Now notice he says he could fall into the condemnation of the devil. What is that? I believe that that means he's liable to fall into the same condemnation in which the devil will fall. And I believe that because I think that's the only way to make sense of it. The devil, remember, is not our judge. And so when we say he's going to fall into the condemnation of the devil, we don't mean that the devil's going to condemn him. Because the devil doesn't get to condemn anybody, does he? Who's the judge? Who gets to condemn? Christ does. Christ is the judge. So when we say somebody could fall into the condemnation of the devil, we don't mean the devil condemning him. And furthermore, the devil would be super glad if everybody would be proud and conceited, wouldn't he? And so the devil's not going to condemn anybody for getting proud and conceited. He's going to say, right on, keep on getting more proud. In fact, he'll probably do whatever he can to feed your pride and to help you to think all the more highly of yourself so that you'll be less and less likely to humble yourself in the sight of the Lord. So we're talking about falling into the condemnation that the devil will receive when we talk about somebody falling into that condemnation. Now, I wanted to bring up the word presbyter again. When we're talking about not being a novice, remember one of the Greek words for the office of an elder is presbyteros. And that is literally translated an elder. Now remember, what are the other words? There's three main words for the office of elder. And what are they? One is presbyteros, which is presbyter or elder. What else? Bishop, or the Greek word episkopos, and that's translated bishop. And that's, what does that mean? Somebody said it. Say it loud. Overseer. Very good. And then the other word is poimen, which means, remember, Caleb is not the pastor. Right. That's because an elder is a pastor or a shepherd. And so when we remember this word in particular, presbyteros or presbyter, that calls to mind that this is to be an older person. And that will be a protection against appointing somebody who's a novice, because you're not looking for a young man. Now, I know that we could go to extremes and start to put an age cap on things, and that we don't want to speak where the Bible has not spoken. But we're looking in general for an experienced man, because he's going to be an older man. This very word has to do with that. Has to do with age. Now, remember last week when you talked about the elder and his family and the elder and his children, you probably talked about he needs to have shown his ability as a father. He needs to have demonstrated his ability as the ruler of his house, ruling well his own house. But somebody who is, in my opinion, somebody who is 25 years old, I think this is just self-evident, somebody who's 25 years old who may have a baby at home, he's not an older man. And he hasn't demonstrated his ability as a father. And not for very long as a husband. And so he's just not qualified yet. And so that's one of many reasons why if Mormon elders come to my door, and I don't mean any disrespect for Mormons, but they have elders who come to the door and they have their elders. Now, I won't call them elders. That's why I won't call them elders, is because I can tell by looking at them, they ain't presbyteroi. You know, they just aren't, because they're not old enough. They're younger than me, and I'm not old enough. And so they're not qualified to be elders. Furthermore, they're single guys, I think. So they just don't meet the qualifications. So I can't call them elder. I'll say Mr. so-and-so. And they may want you to call them that. But I'd advise everyone to say, you should have too high of a regard for the office that God has instituted for you to refer to somebody who is not even remotely possibly qualified to be an elder as one. In the same way that we should have such a high regard for the institute of marriage that we just cannot, I just can't even fathom homosexual marriage. Because it's just so, the concept is just so foreign to the Bible that it's hard for me to even find language to refer to it without compromising what I think ought to be a very high standard of how we even talk about marriage. There is, biblically speaking, there's no such thing as homosexual marriage, is there? Because God designed marriage to start with. And so when I talk about gay marriage, I don't have a vocabulary for it. I guess I have to refer to it as marriage in the legal sense, because that's just the terminology, that's the legal terminology. But biblically speaking, I don't even know how to talk about it. It doesn't even make sense. But at any rate, thinking about the elders, we can't be thinking that people who are novices are qualified, okay? Comments or questions on that? Okay, now, maturity in the faith is required. What this is asking for an elder, is somebody who is mature in the faith, mature as a member of the Church of Christ. And so that might eliminate some people who, in some senses, are not novices. Think about that with me. For one thing, a person could be very old and yet be a novice, couldn't he? How could that happen? He hasn't been a member of the church long. Maybe he's converted when he's 80 years old. And he's perfectly well old. He's old enough to be an elder, but he's not old enough in the faith to be an elder. So he's still a novice. Okay, how about this? He may know a lot about the Bible and still be a novice. Again, if somebody is converted late in life, he may have studied the Bible his whole life, but he was in error. Now, it may be that he's able to become less of a novice more quickly because of already his previous Bible knowledge. But suppose someone comes in and places membership here at Macklin Road, is baptized into Christ, hasn't ever been a Christian before, is baptized into Christ, and he knows a lot about the Bible because he's been in denomination X for many years, obeys the gospel, and we might say he knows more about the Bible than the preacher. It's amazing. He knows more about the Bible than some of our deacons. He knows more about the Bible than this person and this person. Isn't he ready to be an elder? Well, not yet, because he's just become a member of the church. Think about how deep some denominational errors are for a minute. Remember when we had our denominational doctrines class not too long ago and we talked about Calvinism at some length? And you remember how deep-seated Calvinistic doctrine is in the hearts of many people. We saw quotes where people were saying things about babies being born in sin because it's total hereditary depravity that we talked about. And we talked about unconditional election. I'm going through the tulip. Remember the tulip? Unconditional election. We said where people believe that when God calls somebody to be saved, they don't have any will in the matter. They don't have any choice. So God gets to decide without the input of the person being saved. God just makes them saved or not, based upon his own decision having nothing to do with their will. And then we talked about limited atonement, where Jesus died only for a few people. He did not make salvation available to the whole world. He died only for those people that God predestined to be saved, not everybody. So God's a respecter of persons. And then we talked about that the perseverance of the saints. We talked about how that Christians can never fall from grace. Now, and then we talked about irresistible grace. I left the I out. Irresistible grace, which I sort of already referenced, which is that when God decides to make somebody saved, they cannot turn down that offer. And so here's a doctrine that is taught so prevalently in the denominational world. Now follow me on this. Suppose somebody has been taught that his whole life. It may take some time for him to be able to work all that out in his mind and come to grips with what the Bible teaches about salvation all the way around. Now, he may know enough to obey the gospel today, but there may be things about that that he needs to work out in his mind because he's been taught that his whole life, and that may take some time. He may be able to quote all the passages. He may be able to quote many, many verses in the Bible, but if he's been taught Calvinism his whole life, he doesn't become a Christian one day and necessarily be prepared to be an elder even dealing with that matter. He needs to be prepared when somebody comes and tries to teach Calvinism here. You see, if he's an elder, he's responsible for stopping the mouths, as we studied the other week, of people who come in and teach false doctrine. So we got to be real sure that he's got that worked out in his mind. And you could apply that same kind of thinking to whatever denominational doctrine you want. And there are many denominational doctrines that are erroneous. So when somebody's converted, he may know enough to become a Christian. He may realize that he needs the blood of Christ and he needs to be baptized for the remission of sins, whereas in his denomination, they teach that baptism is not for the remission of sins. So he may know enough to obey the gospel, but the working out of all that denominational thinking may take a little while. Does that make sense? Comments or questions? Yes, sir. That's a good point. Somebody's a Christian for many years, and yet hasn't really dedicated himself to Bible study so much. He just hasn't paid enough attention to that aspect of his life. And so he's not ready to defend the church against false doctrines because he doesn't know his Bible well enough. That's certainly possible. So he could be, in the third place, another one, separate one, a man may be very dedicated to the church and yet be in office. So here's somebody who places membership, it obeys the gospel, and look at him. He's getting to the work. He's at the fellowship meals. He's here at every service. He helps with VBS. He's in the visitation program. He's working hard in many areas, and we commend him for that, and we're so thankful for him. Brother Smith, whatever he is, Brother Bob, Brother Jim, Brother so-and-so, we're so thankful for him. And it looks like he might be elder material one day, but he could still be a novice. He could still be not quite ready yet because he hasn't been a member of the church that long. Okay. He has to prove himself. We have to, and this is not mean. This is not us being impatient or too persnickety, but we have to know, if we're serious about 1 Timothy 3, we have to know if somebody meets those qualifications, don't we? That'd be unscriptural if we didn't insist on that. And sometimes churches are real tempted, especially if there's a guy who has a real strong personality and he's very nice and he's very involved and works hard and really wants to be an elder. It would be tempting for a church to kind of fudge on this not a novice thing and say, well, he hadn't been a Christian for very long, but he's so good. We can't imagine him messing up. So let's just go ahead and make him up. That'd be a mistake, wouldn't it? If he's a novice. Okay. How about a man may have a great deal of life experience and yet be a novice? Remember what novice means. Novice means, in this context, somebody, whoop, dropped my thing. So it means somebody newly planted in the church. Newly planted in the church. It does not mean he has no experience at anything. And so somebody might be very wise in terms of his life experience. Have you ever been around somebody who just seems to have done everything? I know some older folks, I love being around them because they're so experienced in everything. And every subject that comes up, he seems to know about it. I like older folks who know a lot about history. One of my teachers at USC was not a historian, but I think he could have taught the history professors a lot of things because everything that came up, especially about the war between the states, we could go on and on about that, and I thought, this guy knows everything, it seems like. But he would never be an elder. For one thing, he wasn't a member of the Lord's church, but, I mean, he was not a novice about history or philosophy. He was one of my philosophy teachers. He was not a novice on that, but he would have been a novice about being a member of the church, and it can be tricky to not get those things mixed up. For example, what if you've got a member of the church who is great in the business world, and he is the most experienced businessman you could hope to meet? He can give everybody in the church investment advice, and their portfolios all go up because he knows what he's doing, and we're so thankful for him. And he may give us a lot of advice about the church budget because he knows finances so well. Here's somebody who can, maybe he's great on computers, and he can do wonderful things on computers, and he's not a novice about that. But let's not get mixed up. What are we talking about? He can't be a novice in the faith. Needs to know the Bible real well, and know that he meets all the other qualifications too. Okay, good. Questions or comments? I feel like I'm talking too much. Y'all stop me. Don't let me talk too much. Okay. Now, a good report. Y'all ready to shift gears and talk about the good report thing? Okay, of good report. The Greek word for good refers to meeting high standards. So if people have high standards for morality, and they ought to, this guy meets them. People in the world think he meets high standards of quality living. Even if they're not members of the church, they see him as somebody who behaves in an exemplary way. The Greek word for report also refers to confirmation or attestation on the basis of personal knowledge or belief. That is, they've observed him. People in the world, some, at least not everybody, but some people, the people who do know him, can attest to the fact, this is a good guy. And you don't ever hear people saying things about him such as, he did me wrong in a business deal. Or, did you see how he was behaving at that restaurant the other night? Did you see how he was treating the waitress? He was real ugly to her. And he is always impatient with people. I mean, when he comes to my store, when he shops at my store, when I see him coming, I don't want to talk to him because he has a bad attitude. And I'm liable to just say something I regret if he comes in my store. And he's so impatient. He jumps on people. So he has a good report. Can't be that way. How about Proverbs 22:1 on this? A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. Does he have a good name? What is his reputation like? That's what we're concerned with here. Now, it says that he could fall into the reproach or the snare of the devil. And I believe that this disgrace in this passage, it says disgrace and a snare of the devil. It's probably the same thing, that he could fall into disgrace, which is a snare of the devil. That he's fallen, you know what a snare is. It's like a trap. And he could fall into that trap of being in disgrace. And it could lead the church to fall into the trap of disgrace. What if a representative of the church is somebody who acts in a way that's not above reproach? Somebody in the church is a leader. He's recognized as being an elder in the church, and he's misbehaving in public. Well, that is a snare for the church. And so the snare, it means reproach or disgrace. Titus 1:8 says that he's got to be just and holy. That's two qualifications over there. And just has to do with how you treat other people. Do you give them justice? Do you give them what they're owed? Do you pay your debts? And when you make a deal with someone, do you follow through on it? Do you keep your promises? That's justice. And then holiness, this is again in Titus 1:8, holiness has to do with how you treat God. Do you live a pious life before God? Are you a praying person? Are you somebody who's faithful to the Lord's church? So just and holy have to do with this blameless thing. What if we appointed somebody an elder, and then you're out in the community one day, and you're talking to an acquaintance, and you say, yeah, we just have a new elder now. We appointed a new elder on Sunday. And the person hears that you appointed that guy, and they say, what? You appointed him? Oh, that's unbelievable that you appointed him, given that he does this. And then you think, oh dear, we didn't know that. See, so we got to do a little checking and make sure that we know that this guy is above reproach, that he has a good report with people. I put this picture of a pie here because I like pie, for one thing, but also because there's a piece of it out. And I mean to show by this that if we see somebody at services, and that's the only environment in which we ever observe them, then we only have really observed a piece of the pie, haven't we? And there's a whole rest of the pie in terms of their time in life and how they spend their time and what they do and how they behave. There's a whole pie. And we need to know a little bit about the rest of that pie, don't we, before we appoint them as elders? Because somebody can put on a pretty good show for a couple hours on Sunday morning and another hour on Sunday night and Wednesday night. But then what about how they are in the community? How does he behave when he's watching his son play football and there's a bad call against his son? What does he say? I remember one of the professors at Freed Hardeman, Bible professors, who had a son playing soccer at Freed Hardeman. And his son was a good soccer player, and he was out watching him play, and the refs made a bad call against his son. At least he thought it was bad. I don't know what it was. I don't know enough about soccer to know. But there's a bad call, and you know what he said? I kind of like this. He said, oh, that was an unfortunate call, like that. And I thought that's a very nice, polite way to say it. But how does he react in cases? How does he react when somebody does him wrong, when somebody insults him? Elders get insulted from time to time. How's he going to respond? You get a pretty good idea of how he's going to respond by seeing how he responds right now. How does he react to things? So get that whole pie. Now, here's a man who's working at a gas station, and he reminds me to tell you a little story about, I know of a preacher who had just taken a pulpit in another state, and this has been some years ago, maybe not this far back, but pretty far back. This is back in the, what decade is that? Some 50s? 40s? It wasn't that far back. It was probably in the 70s, so we're not talking about this far back. But imagine, he goes to the gas station, he's just moved, he's a new preacher. He's the new preacher for that congregation, and he goes to get some gas in town. And this was back when they did have guys to come out and pump your gas for you. So a guy's pumping his gas, and they get to talking. And he says, yeah, I'm the new preacher down at such and such street Church of Christ. And the guy pumping the gas said, "Well, I don't know much about that church, but I know you've got one good Christian man down there." And he named him, and it was one of the elders. And then he told him some reasons why he thought he was that's a good Christian man. So we need to appoint men who are going to have that kind of effect on the community. That when the name comes up, they say, "Oh, yeah, that makes sense. He's a good guy. I can see him being a church leader." That kind of thing. Okay, now here's a good quote from J.W. Shepherd, Brother Shepherd, writing about this issue of the snare or the trap of the devil that somebody will fall into if they're not of good report. And he says this, "Those who once knew him, among other associations, living a very different life, would be only too ready to attack the blameless of the congregation through the stained and scarred reputation of such an elder." What does that mean? Somebody in the community says, "That is the elder of that congregation." Well, that tells you something about that congregation. If they're appointing those kind of people to be elders, I don't want to have anything to do with Macklin Road, for example, if we were to have a bad elder. Oh, I don't want to have anything to do with them. Look at who they appoint for their elders. Now keep reading. Paul charged Timothy to be very watchful when the elders were chosen, to choose only those who in their former days had preserved their good name. Now here's a statement that could mean one of two things. This could be a good thing to say or a bad thing to say. Suppose someone says, here's a teenage boy, and he says, "My friends all look at internet pornography. And I tell them I'm not going to. And they make fun of me because of that. And I've just had to decide that I don't care what they think. I'm just not going to look at internet pornography." Now that's a good thing to say, isn't it? But on the other hand, can you think of a situation where somebody could say those words and it be bad? Same words, but put it in a different context, and it has something to do with what we're talking about tonight. Can you give me a scenario? Yeah, that's right. So this is a good example. So a Christian going somewhere he shouldn't go, like a bar, or going to see a bad movie or something, and if you were ever to say, "You know, I saw you doing this, I'm a little worried about your, you know, are you thinking about letting your Christian light shine or something?" And then he says, "Well, I don't care what anybody thinks about me." Now, that's what we're not looking for in an elder, right? Somebody who has no concern about his reputation whatsoever. He says, "I do whatever I want to do, and I don't ever care a bit how anybody thinks about me." He's not taking care of his name. He's not thinking about his reputation. He doesn't value his good name above riches, like the Proverbs writer says we should. Now, how about how to keep a good name? I've got about 10 suggestions, and we only have about 30 seconds. But let me just put these on the screen, and I've got passages here. And again, if you want the PowerPoint slides, I can make sure you have those. Just give me your email address or talk to me. Worship faithfully with the church. Avoid bad language. Be friendly. Don't take advantage of people. Choose associates carefully. Boy, that's a big one. It's going to be hard for you to have a good reputation if all of your friends have a bad reputation. Because then people are just going to naturally associate you with all those people you constantly hang out with. Not saying we don't have associations with worldly people and bad people sometimes. That can't be avoided. But who are your closest friends? If they're all very bad influences and worldly people, you know what people are going to think you are. They're going to just naturally associate you. And it's going to be hard for you to have that kind of good report that you want to have if you aspire to be an elder. Now, these are all areas in which we need to be training our young people. So that, I'm thinking of the boys, especially now, so that they can be elders one day. Don't let them just start on these things. Don't leave it to them to start on these things once they're 15 years old. If they just start on these things at 15, it's probably too late. Because their characters are so formed by the time they're 15, they're not going to be able to develop into elders unless they make a serious change in their life later on. Now here, keep going. Respect those who deserve your respect. Wear clothes that do not misrepresent you and your Christianity. Modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety. This is especially true for women, but it's true for men as well. Can men wear clothes that misrepresent their profession as Christians? They certainly can. I've seen it recently, especially nowadays with slogans on T-shirts. There are slogans on T-shirts, but also immodest apparel, apparel that makes them look like they're the enemies of the Lord. Okay, we got to finish. I've got those up there. Avoid alcohol. Make friend of hard work. Treat sexuality with respect. Okay. Anything else? Any last word? Okay, thank you very much. See you next week.